Welcome to CraftLit, the podcast for crafters who like books. My name is Heather Wardover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 43, in which our tale begins. So, we're getting to the good stuff now, and I am so excited. I have been thinking about Tale of Two Cities for about 3 weeks straight, and I am so excited to finally get there. But before we do, I have to tell you that Becky, who wrote me weeks ago, because she was catching up on Turn of the Screw, wrote me a very important email, and I've saved it until today because it actually is a spectacular lead-in to Tale of Two Cities. The other thing I was going to tell you is Becky and I were trying to figure out if she could record this herself so that I could play it. I have put an audio link on the website, on the craftlit.blogspot.com, and I think it also works on the craftlit.libsyn.com site. I think they both work. What you can do on the audio thing is you can send me a recorded comment. So that means while we listen to Tale of Two Cities, if you have something you want to share, something you want to say, something you want to point out, something you think I'm missing, record a comment, send it in, I play it, we have a conversation. I love that. So it didn't work out with Becky. I'm going to read her comment to you regardless because I think it's important and it's going to make some people go, oh, see, that's what I was thinking and I just couldn't say it that way. But it also does lead us into Tale of Two Cities. So Becky said, I know I'm way late in commenting about the book, this is Turn of the Screw, but I kept thinking, what about dualism? That seemed to be such a clear theme, but you never mentioned it. The blurring of good and evil, the polarity of thought about good and evil, darkness and light, youth and age, the idea that a screw can turn either way, and that a screw is a perfect image for something that is not clearly in or out, closed or open, but instead spiraling. Henry James is playing with all those concepts and intentionally challenging them by choosing an image that is clearly not dual. And I kept thinking that the explanation for Miles' speech patterns in that scene where he's calling the governess my dear is that he is actually literally possessed, like in The Exorcist, possessed by Peter Quint. It seemed to me that every other sentence he uttered in that scene was from the other guy. That's why it's so unnerving to have this lecherous old guy speaking longingly and searchingly to the governess through Miles' little mouth. And that would explain why, when she tried to remove the spirit from Miles by confronting it, he died. Because his body had been inhabited by the spirit of that other man, so much so that his body could not live without that spirit anymore. Now, I'd gotten emails before from a lot of different people, and we'd kind of been going back and forth about this idea, but none of us were ever able to put it into words quite as well as Becky did. And it does give an interesting twist to what Henry James was trying to do. I really love the image Becky wrote of a screw that's not clearly in or out. You know, it's partway in, or it could go back out, or you don't know what you're dealing with. Very scary, very good, and very important because Tale of Two Cities is all about duality. I had talked to you before about the idea of kind of doing a weird kind of knit-along or create-along while we listen to this. And I am going to put out the challenge. I'm calling it, What Would Madame Defarge Knit? WWMDFK. And the reason I say that is we know very clearly through the narrative what she is in fact supposed to be knitting. But the reality of what she's doing and what it would have looked like and what kind of shape it would have taken, she and her other women. It's not clear. There is no specific information transmitted to us by Dickens. So there's a lot of room for kind of creative thought about what she is actually doing. And we'll kind of percolate more on this as we go along, but I'm very curious to see what you brilliant people who listen to this podcast can come up with about what would Madame Lafarge knit. It's going to be fun. Oh, I'm so excited. So, Tale of Two Cities. Couple things you need to know. One, this was really the first time that Dickens tried to do historical fiction, and he doesn't always come out. Literary criticism is kind of off and on with this. Some people think he did a brilliant job. Some people think, you know, what he's really good at is characters like Scrooge and Marley, you know, coming up with names for people that fit their character, Scrooge probably being the most famous. And he has some of those characters in this book, and they are welcome relief when we hit them. But people think he's pretty uneven at going, you know, straight plot historical fiction. I personally think he did a really good job. I think what he set out to do is what he actually accomplished. And you know how big a deal that is for me, because I hated the book in high school. And I figured out, I read the first four chapters, and they're boring. And I'm warning you right now, they're boring. The fifth chapter is when it starts to get good. So hang with me at least until the fifth chapter. And on that note, when I worked for Disney on the film Aladdin, every once in a while someone would say, no, we can't do that. It's Prince Generic. And if you remember Ariel and the Little Mermaid, the prince's name is Eric. And he's kind of, I mean, he's cute, he's okay. But the people at Disney called him Prince Generic because they were just bored. Well, the lovers, Lucy Manette and Charles Darnay in Tale of Two Cities, are the least interesting people in the book. I personally think that's the way it's supposed to be, because you're not supposed to pay as much attention to them as you are to the other things that are happening. So Dickens got criticized for this, and I think he did the right thing. I think he did this on purpose to force us to pay attention to stuff that we wouldn't otherwise. We would be reading the romance, and we would be getting swept up into it, and that's what we do. You know, it's like, oh, they're so wonderful, they're in love, this is fabulous. No, he doesn't really want you to look at that. There's other stuff that's far more important. Look over here. So I'm just warning you, don't be surprised when you go, wow, they have no personality. You should also know that Dickens was ambivalent at best about the Revolution. He is very, very clear about how horrible the conditions were in France. And you will be shocked at some of the descriptions of things that I'm positive are true. You know, he didn't live all that long past the French Revolution. The Reign of Terror didn't end all that long ago for him. So it is obvious to me, and the lit crit that I've read has kind of supported this, he heard plenty of real stories about what was going on in France prior to the Revolution. And he's really, really clear that that's bad. He's also pretty clear that the response by the normal people, the peasants, the middle and the lower classes, was also pretty bad. And that's interesting, because you don't often see somebody say, yeah, they're bad, so are you. You know, when there's a revolution, we tend to, especially in America, we tend to side with the underdogs or the revolutionaries, because we were. And sometimes you have to look at what the revolutionaries are doing and going, you know, you're not Gandhi. Gandhi's hard to argue with. You're not Gandhi. We can argue with you and your methods pretty easily. And that is definitely what you see in Dickens's kind of commentary on the French Revolution. I'm also warning you, it'll make you cry. I spent a good week while I was listening to this. Oh, it made me cry. It was great. And there's also more knitting in the book than I thought there would be, which is kind of fun. I am going to start the book now, but I am warning you, the first chapter, which is the setup of the dualities, and for those of you who remember, it starts with, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. He couldn't make it any clearer for you. He is going to show you both sides of the coin. The chapter is very much a product of its time, and there are a lot of little side comments and jokes that I wound up researching just so I could fill in the blanks for you and make what I think has become a rather dull, although short, chapter into something that's at least meaningful, if not interesting. This is the only time I've ever done this so far. I don't know if I'm ever going to have to do it again, but this chapter, I think, demanded that I break into the narrative and say, okay, did you hear that? What he's talking about is, and then I'll let the narrative go up. Because I know that might be extraordinarily frustrating to some of you, I am putting a link in the show notes to the LibriVox site so that if you want an untarnished version of this chapter, an unspoiled narrative, you can get it. I'm also warning you, as we head into this book, not all of the chapters are read very well. You will very quickly have some favorite readers. There's one British gentleman who does an extraordinary job on accents, and there's Chip, who we all fell in love with from Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and he's wonderful. And then there are some fine, they're just fine readers, and then there are some appallingly bad ones. I will be reading those chapters. I'm not going to make you suffer through that. But I am going to point out one interesting thing to you. When Americans read Cockney accents, or what would be considered to be kind of lower class British working class accents, Americans go Southern. It's just something I've noticed. So I'm warning you, nobody in this book is from Dixie. But every once in a while, they'll sound like it. So that's what we get for having free books on tape. You do what you can with what you got. So I think I've set things up. We start with our dualities. I'll fill in the blanks as we go. It's so good to be back, and it's so good to have such a good book to launch into this week. It's making what's been a very trying time into a very happy one. And so, with no further ado, I give you Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
Book One, Recalled to Life. Book One, Chapter One, The Period. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only.
All right, so here I am, back again. This is Dickens setting up the fact that, number one, nothing has changed. The most superlative degree of comparison possible is it is the most like that time now. So he's equating some of the things that England is going through in his time with the things that were happening back in the late 1700s. Late 1700s, you're getting the end of the Enlightenment. Remember, this is when the Americans are doing the Declaration of Independence, and you have Thomas Jefferson quoting Locke and Rousseau. And so you've got the Enlightenment on the one hand, and then you've got the kind of the Industrial Revolution and the horrible, horrible working conditions so many people were living in. You've got these two things juxtaposed. And one of the things to remember as we get further into this narrative is that after the Enlightenment, you get the Romantics and you get the Gothic period. So kind of the flip side of the coin is you go from this age of wisdom into this age of superstition and mysticism and belief in the supernatural. And he's seeing the same things happening in his time. All right, so we're going to go back.
There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a plain face on the throne of England. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a fair face on the throne of France. In both countries it was clearer than crystal to the lords of the state preserves of loaves and fishes that things in general were settled for ever. It was the year of our Lord, 1775. Spiritual revelations were conceded to England at that favored period, as at this. Mrs. Southcott had recently attained her 25th blessed birthday, of whom a prophetic private in the lifeguards had heralded the sublime appearance by announcing that arrangements were made for the swallowing up of London and Westminster. Even the Cock Lane ghost had been laid only a round dozen of years after rapping out its messages, as the spirits of this very year last past, supernaturally deficient in originality, rapped out theirs.
All right, that was a surprisingly large amount of information that he just popped out at you. So, it's 1775. You know what's going on in America at that time. We have George III on the throne. He's a nut. You have Louis on the throne with his beautiful wife in France. What you might not know is that there was this big spiritual movement that was happening in the late 1700s, and there's a big spiritual movement that happens in England again in the mid-1800s. In the earlier time, 1775, there was a woman named Miss Southcott who's absolutely convinced that she was getting spiritual visitations, and she didn't call it this, but she was channeling prophetic voices, and she kept prophesying the end of the world. There are still people today who believe that she was right, and they have a whole lot of stuff of hers that she's interesting. And I have a link to some of her information on the homepage. But she was this big spiritualist, and she was 25 at the time. Then there was the Cock Lane ghost. This was supposed to have been the ghost of a, some people thought murdered, other people said she died of smallpox, woman who came back to tell on her husband, having killed her. It turns out that whatever happened in the beginning, I don't know if there was a ghost or not, but whatever had happened in the beginning, the family that it happened to figured out that they could make a lot of money by having the ghost talk to them and having people pay to hear it happen. So it was the Cock Lane was the name of the street, and it was the Cock Lane ghost. And it was such a big deal that some really major people decided to go and study it. And they did it under very dubious circumstances. And as a consequence, nobody really knows. They think it was mostly a gag. But I don't know. So you have all of this stuff going on, and he says that the ghosts in his time really haven't learned anything new since the Cock Lane ghost. They're just not as original. I love that.
Mere messages in the earthly order of events had lately come to the English crown and people from a congress of British subjects in America, which, strange to relate, have proved more important to the human race than any communications yet received through any of the chickens of the Cock Lane brood.
Yeah, so he was just joking about us. Now, the Congress of British Subjects in America, that would be our Continental Congress, turned out to be more important than any of the Cock Lane ghosts' tales, which was, I thought, very generous of him. You know, Americans are not so highly regarded. I love it.
France, less favored on the whole as to matters spiritual than her sister of the shield and trident, rolled with exceeding smoothness downhill, making paper money and spending it. Under the guidance of her Christian pastors, she entertained herself, besides, with such humane achievements as sentencing a youth to have his hands cut off, his tongue torn out with pincers, and his body burned alive, because he had not kneeled down in the rain to do honor to a dirty procession of monks which passed within his view at a distance of some 50 or 60 yards.
All right, so you're starting to get the picture that stuff in France was not so good at this time. if the way the church was dealing with a kid not kneeling down was to kill him that way, that's bad. And Dickens will continue to give some rather graphic depictions of stuff like this happening. And it's bad, no question.
It is likely enough that rooted in the woods of France and Norway there were growing trees when that sufferer was put to death, already marked by the woodman, fate, to come down and be sawn into boards, to make a certain movable framework with a sack and a knife in it, terrible in history.
So that's a guillotine he's talking about, a certain movable framework with a knife. That's a guillotine. So he's saying that while this was all happening, there were probably trees that were already marked by fate as the trees that were going to become guillotines.
It is likely enough that in the rough outhouses of some tillers of the heavy lands adjacent to Paris, there were sheltered from the weather that very day rude carts, bespattered with rustic mire, snuffed about by pigs, and roosted in by poultry, which the farmer, Death, had already set apart to be his tumbrils of the revolution. But that woodman and that farmer, though they work unceasingly, work silently, and no one heard them as they went about with muffled tread, the rather forasmuch as to entertain any suspicion that they were awake was to be atheistical and traitorous. In England, there was scarcely an amount of order and protection to justify much national boasting. Daring burglaries by armed men and highway robberies took place in the capital itself every night. Families were publicly cautioned not to go out of town without removing their furniture to upholsterers' warehouses for security. The highwayman in the dark was a city tradesman in the light, and, being recognized and challenged by his fellow tradesmen, whom he stopped in the character of the captain, gallantly shot him through the head and rode away.
So you're getting the picture that Dickens wasn't all that thrilled with what was going on in England either. It was not a lawful time. I know we have this picture because they all wore, you know, beautiful clothes. The rich people, anyway, had really gorgeous stuff to wear. That it was a time when everything was more mannered and more, I don't know, kind of the nostalgia for the it never really happened times gone by. The highwaymen were hardcore. It's not Robin Hood. And his point that the highwayman in the night was the tradesman during the day is a particularly damning thing. And you'll actually see that pop up again in the rest of the narrative, somebody who has a day job and a night job.
The mail was waylaid by 7 robbers, and the guard shot 3 dead, and then got shot himself by the other 4 in consequence of the failure of his ammunition, after which the mail was robbed in peace. That magnificent potentate, the Lord Mayor of London, was made to stand and deliver on Turnham Green by 1 highwayman, who despoiled the illustrious creature in sight of all his retinue. Prisoners in London jails fought battles with their turnkeys, and the majesty of the law fired blunderbusses in among them, loaded with rounds of shot and ball.
I have included a picture of a blunderbuss on the show notes website because it shows up, the term shows up over and over again. If you think of the old-fashioned, I think of it as a turkey gun. It's a gun with a kind of a flared muzzle. So, it shot out shot, but it had a flare instead of a narrow barrel. Or a pirate gun, if you think of it like a pirate gun. That's the image to have. And they came in 2 sizes. They came in rifle sizes and they came in pistol sizes. So now you've got it in your head.
Thieves snipped off diamond crosses from the necks of noble lords at court drawing rooms. Musketeers went into St. Giles to search for contraband goods, and the mob fired on the musketeers, and the musketeers fired on the mob, and nobody thought any of these occurrences much out of the common way. In the midst of them, the hangman, ever busy and ever worse than useless, was in constant requisition, now stringing up long rows of miscellaneous criminals, now hanging a housebreaker on Saturday who had been taken on Tuesday, now burning people in the hand at Newgate by the dozen, and now burning pamphlets at the door of Westminster Hall, today taking the life of an atrocious murderer, and tomorrow of a wretched pilferer who had robbed a farmer's boy of 6 pence. All these things, and 1,000 like them, came to pass, in and close upon the dear old year 1775. Environed by them, while the woodman and the farmer worked unheeded, those two of the large jaws, and those other two of the plain and fair faces, trod with stir enough, and carried their divine rights with a high hand. Thus did the year 1775 conduct their greatnesses, and myriads of small creatures, the creatures of this chronicle among the rest, along the roads that lay before them. End of Book One, Chapter One.
Okay, so Dickens has set up kind of the historical framework for the story. You've got the best times, the worst times, you've got lots of money somewhere, and then a lot of it with the church, and then you've got all sorts of stuff happening to just normal people. Now he's going to take you into just normal people slogging along in a mail coach on the road at night. And he's just told us about highwaymen. So you're supposed to be worried. I'm just telling you. And we also get introduced to two very important characters who will stick with us for the entire book, and you will be so glad they did. Jerry Cruncher and Jarvis Lorry.
Book One, Chapter Two, The Mail. It was the Dover Road that lay, on a Friday night, late in November, before the first of the persons with whom this history has business. The Dover Road lay, as to him, beyond the Dover Mail, as it lumbered up Shooter's Hill. He walked up hill in the mire by the side of the mail, as the rest of the passengers did, not because they had the least relish for walking exercise, under the circumstances, but because the hill and the harness and the mud and the mail were all so heavy that the horses had three times already come to a stop, besides once drawing the coach across the road with the mutinous intent of taking it back to Blackheath. Reins and whip and coachman and guard, however, in combination, had read that article of war which forbade a purpose otherwise strongly in favor of the argument that some brute animals are endued with reason, and the team had capitulated and returned to their duty. With drooping heads and tremulous tails, they mashed their way through the thick mud, floundering and stumbling between whiles, as if they were falling to pieces at the larger joints. As often as the driver rested them and brought them to a stand, with a wary, "Whoa-ho! So-ho, then!" the near leader violently shook his head and everything upon it, like an unusually emphatic horse, denying that the coach could be got up the hill. Whenever the leader made this rattle, the passenger started, as a nervous passenger might, and was disturbed in mind. There was a steaming mist in all the hollows, and it had roamed in its forlornness up the hill, like an evil spirit, seeking rest and finding none. A clammy and intensely cold mist, it made its slow way through the air in ripples that visibly followed and overspread one another, as the waves of an unwholesome sea might do. It was dense enough to shut out everything from the light of the coach lamps but these its own workings, and a few yards of road, and the reek of the laboring horses steamed into it, as if they had made it all. Two other passengers, besides the one, were plodding up the hill by the side of the mail. All three were wrapped to the cheekbones and over the ears, and wore jackboots. Not one of the three could have said, from anything he saw, what either of the other two was like, and each was hidden under almost as many wrappers from the eyes of the mind as from the eyes of the body of his two companions. In those days, travelers were very shy of being confidential on a short notice, for anybody on the road might be a robber or in league with robbers. As to the latter, when every posting-house and ale-house could produce somebody in the captain's pay, ranging from the landlord to the lowest stable nondescript, it was the likeliest thing upon the cards. So the guard of the Dover Mail thought to himself, that Friday night in November, 1775, lumbering up Shooter's Hill, as he stood on his own particular perch behind the mail, beating his feet and keeping an eye and a hand on the arm chest before him, where a loaded blunderbuss lay at the top of 6 or 8 loaded horse pistols, deposited on a substratum of cutlass. The Dover mail was in its usual genial position that the guard suspected the passengers suspected one another and the guard, they all suspected everybody else, and the coachman was sure of nothing but the horses, as to which cattle he could with a clear conscience have taken his oath on the 2 testaments that they were not fit for the journey. "Whoa-ho!" said the coachman. "So then, one more pull, and you're at the top and be damned to you, for I have had trouble enough to get you to it. Joe!" "Hello!" the guard replied. "What o'clock do you make it, Joe?" 10 minutes, good, past 11. "My blood!" ejaculated the vexed coachman. "And not a top of Shooter's yet. Tss! Yah! Get on with you!" The emphatic horse, cut short by the whip in a most decided negative, made a decided scramble for it, and the 3 other horses followed suit. Once more the Dover mail struggled on, with the jackboots of its passengers squashing along by its side. They had stopped when the coach stopped, and they kept close company with it. If any one of the 3 had had the hardihood to propose to another to walk on a little ahead into the mist and darkness, he would have put himself in a fair way of getting shot instantly as a highwayman. The last burst carried the mail to the summit of the hill. The horses stopped to breathe again, and the guard got down to skid the wheel for the descent and open the coach door to let the passengers in. "Tss! Joe!" cried the coachman in a warning voice, looking down from his box. "What do you say, Tom?" They both listened. "I say, a horse at a canter coming up, Joe." "I say, a horse at a gallop, Tom," returned the guard, leaving his hold of the door and mounting nimbly to his place. "Gentlemen, in the king's name, all of you!" With this hurried adjuration he cocked his blunderbuss and stood on the offensive. The passenger booked by this history was on the coach step, getting in. The 2 other passengers were close behind him, and about to follow. He remained on the step, half in the coach and half out of it. They remained in the road below him. They all looked from the coachman to the guard, and from the guard to the coachman, and listened. The coachman looked back, and the guard looked back, and even the emphatic leader pricked up his ears and looked back, without contradicting. The stillness consequent on the cessation of the rumbling and laboring of the coach, added to the stillness of the night, made it very quiet indeed. The panting of the horses communicated a tremulous motion to the coach, as if it were in a state of agitation. The hearts of the passengers beat loud enough, perhaps, to be heard, but at any rate the quiet pause was audibly expressive of people out of breath, and holding the breath, and having the pulses quickened by expectation. The sound of a horse at a gallop came fast and furiously up the hill. "So-ho!" the guard sang out, as loud as he could roar. "Yo there! Stand! I shall fire!" The pace was suddenly checked, and, with much splashing and floundering, a man's voice called from the mist. "Is that the Dover mail?" "Never you mind what it is," the guard retorted. "What are you?" "Is that the Dover mail?" "Why do you want to know?" "I want a passenger, if it is." "What passenger?" "Mr. Jarvis Lorry." Our booked passenger showed in a moment that it was his name. The guard, the coachman, and the 2 other passengers eyed him distrustfully. "Keep where you are," the guard called to the voice in the mist, "because, if I should make a mistake, it could never be set right in your lifetime. Gentlemen of the name of Lorry, answer straight." "What is the matter?" asked the passenger then, with mildly quavering speech. "Who wants me? Is it Jerry?" "I don't like Jerry's voice, if it is Jerry," growled the guard to himself. "He's hoarser than suits me, is Jerry." "Yes, Mr. Lorry." "What is the matter?" "A despatch sent after you from over yonder. Tea and company." "I know this messenger, guard," said Mr. Lorry, getting down into the road, assisted from behind more swiftly than politely by the other two passengers, who immediately scrambled into the coach, shut the door, and pulled up the window. "He may come close. There's nothing wrong." "I hope there ain't, but I can't make so nation sure of that," said the guard, in gruff soliloquy. "Hallo, you!" "Well, and hallo, you!" said Jerry, more hoarsely than before. "Come on at a foot pace, d'ye mind me? And if you've got holsters to that saddle of yourn, don't let me see your hand go nigh 'em, for I'm a devil at a quick mistake, and when I make one it takes the form of lead. So now let's look at you." The figures of a horse and rider came slowly through the eddying mist, and came to the side of the mail, where the passenger stood. The rider stooped, and, casting up his eyes at the guard, handed the passenger a small folded paper. The rider's horse was blown, and both horse and rider were covered with mud, from the hoofs of the horse to the hat of the man. "Guard," said the passenger, in a tone of quiet business confidence. The watchful guard, with his right hand at the stock of his raised blunderbuss, his left at the barrel, and his eye on the horseman, answered curtly, "Sir?" "There is nothing to apprehend. I belong to Tellson's Bank. You must know Tellson's Bank in London. I am going to Paris on business. A crown to drink. May I read this?"
"If so be as you're quick, sir."
He opened it in the light of the coach lamp on that side, and read, first to himself and then aloud, "Wait at Dover for Mamselle." "It's not long, you see, guard. Jerry, say that my answer was recalled to life." Jerry started in his saddle.
"That's a blazing strange answer, too," said he, at his hoarsest.
"Take that message back, and they will know that I received this, as well as if I wrote. Make the best of your way. Good night." With those words, the passenger opened the coach door and got in, not at all assisted by his fellow passengers, who had expeditiously secreted their watches and purses in their boots, and were now making a general pretense of being asleep. With no more definite purpose than to escape the hazard of originating any other kind of action. The coach lumbered on again, with heavier wreaths of mist closing round it as it began the descent. The guard soon replaced his blunderbuss in his arm-chest, and, having looked to the rest of its contents, and having looked to the supplementary pistols that he wore in his belt, looked to a smaller chest beneath his seat, in which there were a few smith's tools, a couple of torches, and a tinder-box. For he was furnished with that completeness that if the coach lamps had been blown and stormed out, which did occasionally happen, he had only to shut himself up inside, keep the flint and steel sparks well off the straw, and get a light with tolerable safety and ease, if he were lucky, in 5 minutes. "Tom!" softly over the coach roof.
"Hello, Joe."
"Did you hear the message?"
"I did, Joe."
"What did you make of it, Tom?"
"Nothing at all, Joe."
"That's a coincidence, too," the guard mused, "for I made the same of it myself." Jerry, left alone in the mist and darkness, dismounted meanwhile, not only to ease his spent horse, but to wipe the mud from his face and shake the wet out of his hat-brim, which might be capable of holding about half a gallon. After standing with the bridle over his heavily splashed arm until the wheels of the mail were no longer within hearing, and the night was quite still again,
He turned to walk down the hill. "After that there gallop from Temple Bar, old lady, I won't trust your forelegs till I get you on the level," said this hoarse messenger, glancing at his mare. "Recalled to life. That's a blazing strange message. Much of that wouldn't do for you, Jerry. I say, Jerry, you'd be in a blazing bad way if recalling to life was to come into fashion, Jerry." End of Book 1, Chapter 2, The Mail.
Yeah, so I know it's hard to hear that Jerry's actually a funny character, but Jerry's actually a funny character. And the whole recalled to life thing is, it's supposed to be mysterious because Dickens wrote this as a serial, as he did many of his longer works. He was publishing these for magazines. So many of the chapters are really quite brief, maybe 15, maybe only 10 minutes. Occasionally we'll have a chapter that's a good 20, 25 minutes long, but that's rare. And most of them have some kind of cliffhanger at the end. So now we have Jarvis Lorry, who's gotten a message that Mamselle is going to be waiting for him. We don't know who she is. We have Jerry Cruncher, who came out of nowhere with this message. We don't know who he is, but clearly he and Jarvis Lorry know each other. And we have this very odd statement, recalled to life. And Jerry's point is, as a professional messenger, if that was the kind of message he was to get all the time, he would be out of a job, because you don't really need to be sending such brief messages around. Usually these guys memorized much longer statements that they had to relay. They, you know, they were the telephones of their day. But now we have the mystery that begins the book is set up. There's a woman. There's somebody who's been recalled to life. We have this businessman from Tellson's Bank who is buddies, or at least acquaintances, with a guy who should have a very thick Cockney accent, and will shortly, I promise. You will hear him read with a very thick Cockney accent. And that's the beginning of the book. Next week, the first chapter we get will let us see some insight into Jerry Cruncher. And, you know, Dickens does a nice job with funny people. And then we'll find out a little bit more about the whole mysterious Mamselle and what's going on there. And so I hope you tune in again. I'm certainly having fun, and it's so good to be back. I hope you all have a great week. Honestly, I hope I do too. And I'll talk to you in a week. Have a good one. Bye. You can find a blog for this podcast at craftlit.blogspot.com. or craftlit.libsyn.com. That's craftlit, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T, all one word, and Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And of course, you can subscribe at iTunes. And do remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.